Our guest on this podcast is someone I've talked with many, many times in the past. Indeed, I presume to count him a friend, though that could be dangerous because Joe Epstein did a book some years ago titled Friendship, an Exposé. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by it, I was trying to pierce the standard cliches of friendship, as a sort of straightforward and glorious relationship in every case, to show the complexity of it, the difficulty of it, the range and variety of it. In the book, as I recall, I invented a card, a kind of Hallmark card that read, "We've been friends for so long. Don't you think it's time we stop?"
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Which, you know how friendship is full of variety and richness.
By the way, have you ever?
I think you may presume to call yourself my friend.
But now there's a danger that you may, when we finish this conversation, tell me we've been friends for so long, maybe it's time to stop.
I'm out of stock on those cards, so you're safe.
All right. Actually, of course, you've looked at the virtues and some of the pleasures of life, and friendship, the book on friendship, it deals with one of the great pleasures, but it's a complicated pleasure. But you also have essentially gone at the seven deadly sins. You haven't done all seven yet, have you?
No. Well, I did envy it, and I have to tell you about that in this connection. It looks now, as I look back on so much of the writing I've done, it looks like I'm sort of putting together a long oeuvre involving the sins and virtues. But, a lot of it came about quite by accident. For example, the Envy book, Oxford University Press was planning a series on envy. And when they came to me, all that was left was envy, sloth, and lust. And I didn't think I was up to lust, very frankly, at the time. I didn't want to be the lust guy. And sloth, though interesting, didn't seem to be as interesting as envy. So in some cases, these things were not even my ideas. But, of course, once one gets into them, one finds all the rich, sweet complexity of them.
You've chosen well. But, of course, earlier you also did books on, which of the other deadly sins have you already transacted?
Well, I think that is actually the only sort of deadly sin. Well, I did snobbery, which is not a
snobbery.
Deadly sin.
Yeah.
And in a way, that was my commercially most successful book. It was a so-called bestseller, a New York Times bestseller, which I don't want on my tombstone. But once you're, have that said after your name, it never comes off, I'm afraid.
I want to get to envy and to snobbery in just a moment. But first, a word or two about your very interesting, rather varied, and surely distinguished career. You are, of course, basically a literary person, and you've done many books of literary essays, appreciating, analyzing, and finding the fuller meaning, and also developing some of the biographical detail on a tremendous list of writers, some of them very well known, some of them less well known. I must confess, or I must simply tell you, that I discovered a writer whom I much enjoy by reading your essay on her. I had literally never heard of her before. And that is Barbara Pym.
Ah, how nice to hear that.
P-I-M.
Good. And you don't want your money back. She was the real thing for you, I take it, as she is for me.
I think she was for you as well.
Yes,
so you matched her with a sometime friend of hers, a very different, disgruntled fellow who is a kind of major modern poet.
Mm-hmm. Philip Larkin, of course.
Philip Larkin.
Who there's a wonderful letter of Philip Larkin's to his publisher saying how he really ought to publish Barbara Pym and not publish scandalous characters like Norman Mailer and Jimmy Baldwin and such, when there's this genuine writer who is being ignored. Larkin is a complicated and wonderful case. He's the only poet of the last half of the 20th century whom anyone seems to remember lines of his. I have a little thing about poetry. I think in some strange way, it's finished. I don't mean to say that people don't walk around with lots of lines from T.S. Eliot and Robert Frost and Wallace Stevens even in their heads. But if you ask someone to to memorize, to say, read a passage that he or she's memorized of something written in the last 50 years, very few people can do it. Even of the Randall Jarrells and the Robert Lowells. I think once...
With Randall Jarrell, one remembers the death of the, the bell turret gunner, how they wash his remains out at the end of the poem.
Exactly. That's very good, though. That's exactly what I remember, too. But there's not the phrases that, you know, one used to pop around, you know, like a patient etherized upon a table and so forth and so on. But poetry, it just goes on. People solemnly churn it away, full of self-importance. And poets give each other prizes, but I don't think many people are really reading it, which I'm not pleased at this prospect, but I think it's a kind of socio-literary fact.
Gee, that moves me to ask you something I've never even conjectured about before. Have you, Joseph Epstein, ever committed a poem?
I committed one poem to print.
Yes.
And it's a poem about my friend Edward Schills.
Ah, yes.
And it was printed in the magazine First Things. And having printed that one poem, I'm allowed to wear black turtleneck sweaters wherever I go.
Another one of your books, this is not one of the seven deadly sins, but it might almost have been listed there. Preachers often rail against this particular indulgence, namely gossip.
Yes, that's up there, and you're right. It is that. Gossip, what fascinated me about gossip was, you know, knowing the strong case about it, I nevertheless find myself, as I suspect you do too, interested in it, charmed by it, with an unending appetite for it, if it's the right kind of gossip, you know, if it's at the right level. Gossip is very much connected with one's age, I find. For example, you can tell me 7,000 Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie stories, and I'd fall asleep on the third one. Whereas if you tell me an interesting story about Evelyn Waugh and Nancy Mitford, I'm ready to go. I'm sort of a, like you, I suspect, also a kind of highbrow gossip.
Well, you go for literary gossip and political gossip.
And political, too, is of interest.
One cannot resist, though, the spectacle, say, of those two rather strange political candidates in New York at the moment. I note that even you have brought yourself to write a little bit about them.
Mr. Spitzer and Messrs. Spitzer and Wiener.
Exactly.
Yeah, I wrote a little piece where, a little fantasy in which I assume that if someone were to return to Philip Roth Portnoy's complaint, they would be perfect as Portnoy's children.
Yes.
You know, sexual fantasies.
It's a lovely conceit, as they sometimes say in literary circles. And I enjoyed it tremendously.
Oh, I'm pleased.
Let me go to gossip for a moment. We just have to poke around some of these sins. You borrow a definition from Earl Wilson, who used to write as a gossip columnist, indeed, for the New York Post. And he defines gossip this way. Gossip is when you hear something you like about someone you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Does that work?
I think it still holds up. For example, if you, let's say you like George W. Bush.
Yeah.
I happen to like George W. Bush. I know it's probably among intellectuals a minority opinion. I'm not so keen to hear terrible things about him.
Of course.
You know, because I've met him briefly once, and I found him a very sort of winning person. But if there's someone one doesn't like, then bring it on. I'll tell you another thing connected with this, not quite gossip, but if there's someone you dislike, you don't want to hear good or sad things about him. For example, let's say there's a novelist that you dislike, and then you learn, you know, he struggled with four autistic children. And you say, oh, I don't want to hear that. It'll make me sympathize with him. But there's a letter, I don't know if you've ever noted it, Milton, one of George Orwell's letters is to Stephen Spender. And in it he says, they had just met at some sort of a cocktail party, literary party of some kind. And he says, you know, before I met you, I thought of you and wrote about you as a communist sympathizer, which I think Spender was. I think he actually used the phrase Orwell as the type of a pansy poet. And now that I meet you, I find you're quite an agreeable person, and therefore can no longer treat you with the same clean brutality that I used to do. He said, this is one of the reasons I don't go out very much.
It's interesting. You are now working on a book about charm. And it occurs to me that one of the great dangers you run, if you've got some well-developed disdain for particular figures, a great danger you run if you're out in the social world, you might meet them, might meet the object of some of your hate, and find him or her to be, quote, charming.
Yes. Oh, no. It's
That disrupts you.
It's a very great danger.
Yeah.
You know, there's the reversal of this. This is a story I'm sure
oh,
you
yes.
love. I probably heard. You know what? I'm going to tell you about this Hilton Kramer story. Do you know the story? In any case,
I knew Hilton Kramer, as you did, of course.
Of course you do. Of course you do. He was the art critic for the New York Times for many years, and then later the editor of the New Criterion. And Hilton was the most fearless critic I've ever encountered in this regard.
Very tough guy. Yeah.
Very tough, and I think the great polemicist of his age in cultural matters. But in any case, Woody Allen at some party, this must have been way back in the days when Hilton Kramer was still a Farrar, Straus, Giroux author and went to the kinds of parties that Woody Allen would show up at with Susan Sontag and such people. And Woody Allen said to Hilton Kramer, Mr. Kramer, what is it like when you meet an artist, a visual artist, that you've thoroughly trashed in the New York Times? Aren't you nervous? Aren't you embarrassed? And Hilton said without the least hesitation, he said, embarrassed? By God, no. He said, he should be embarrassed for creating such crappy art.
Yeah.
You know, I must say, I don't have that kind of courage. If I were to have written critically of someone, I'd be very much on edge about meeting him. But your point is the more interesting one of someone you don't think well of, and he turns out to be agreeable.
Yes, how dare you?
Somebody once told me, someone I've written harshly about is the literary critic Stanley Fish, and somebody told me that he's really quite a nice fellow when you meet him. So my ploy is not to meet him. You see the kind of courage you're dealing with.
Well, I avoided meeting him for some 5 or 6 years, the years he spent in Chicago running the English department at UIC.
So he was the dean, was he not, of the art
Ultimately,
college?
I think they deaned him as well, to be sure.
Right.
You've been in so many different games. One of them, of course, is literature, which I've already mentioned. Somebody of some interest to you, I'm sure, was the writer and public personality Truman Capote. He says, this is a four-word quotation, and I wonder if it makes sense. It makes some sort of sense. I want you to tell me what it is. He says, quite simply, all literature is gossip.
Well, that's it. That is, yes, there is a sense in which that's true. I think it wouldn't be the first nor the last word about literature, but the novel is full of gossip. In fact, you know, in the old days, the formulation for the novel is bringing the news.
Yeah.
You know, gossip about how the aristocracy lives, gossip about how the working
yes,
classes live.
Yes, the word for news in French is nouvelle.
Nouvelle, yeah. So there is that. He was Truman Capote was in many ways a charming man who kind of ran out of gas on his charm. I suppose he did so because of, this isn't really quite gossip. It's so well known because of his drinking problems. And
well, there was something else, though. Wasn't there something else that relates to gossip? He was working on a novel. You will remember its title. I don't. It was never finished.
I think, was it Unanswered Prayers?
Unanswered Prayers. And it was a novel of a gossip about four or five leading society mesdames in New York who had indulged him for many years.
That's
and
correct.
He was very brutal to them, apparently.
Well, he published a chapter of it in Esquire, as I remember.
That was it, yes.
I remember one of the people was Babe Paley. Another was a woman with the wonderful name of Slim Keith.
Yes.
And, you know, and this was his sort of his crowd for a while. And he somehow must have thought, so charming was he, that they would understand that he's making literature out of them. They didn't look at it this way at all. They were deeply offended. I remember in the chapter, I think he has a woman who was clearly Babe Paley's husband, William Paley, who was the head of CBS. committing adultery in a kind of brutish way against her and so forth and so on. But he could be so charming as a writer. And of course, he was someone who would go on television and say astonishing things in that piping, fruity voice.
His greatest line ever, or at least one of them that I've always treasured, he's being interviewed by, I forget whom, but one of the famous interviewers of that time, who asks him, "What do you think of the writing of Jack Kerouac?" To which he responds, "You know the line?
That's not writing, that's typing."
Exactly, yes.
Yes. Yes. He had a thing about, was it Jackie Collins? I mean, he said, she's a truck driver in drag.
Uh-huh.
I've always suspected she's a truck.
Yeah.
In the book on gossip, I have a chapter called Gay Gossip.
Mm-hmm.
And gays were very good at saying outrageous things, Capote among them. And Tennessee Williams specialized in it. And Noel Coward was very, very good at it. There was a generation of sophisticated gay men who they were much more impressive to me than current day gay men, which when they write are more likely to describe their what goes on in gay sex, which is of no interest to me at all. But that earlier generation was very impressive. To jump a little on you, in this book on charm, I have a chapter called The Charmingest Generation,
uh-huh.
which is a takeoff from Tom Brokaw's book about
mm-hmm. The Greatest Generation.
The Greatest Generation, the World War II generation. And I sort of, in thinking about it, I came to feel that the Charmingest Generation was that generation of black jazz musicians who came into maturity in the 20s and 30s, who were so elegant. Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Fats Waller, and not only were they unfailingly charming and elegant and talented, but they were so against a background of the harshest racial prejudice, and they kept their charm and cool, and to me they're immensely impressive.
Speaking of intellectuals of a passing era or of a passing time. One of them who has just finally passed and is certainly a literary figure of some prominence is Gore Vidal. And with regard to envy, he got off a great line. It's mm-hmm. brutal in its honesty about mm-hmm. how mean and nasty one can be. He simply said, "It is not enough that I succeed. My friends must fail."
That's a perfect Vidalian line.
It is indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. No. He was not a favorite of mine. He was clearly, in that generation of gay men that I was referring to, but he was terribly marred for me and will be everlastingly for what I thought was this fairly strident anti-Semitism.
Oh yes, it was there. You know,
I think he felt. I think the great hole in Gore Vidal's armor was he never felt sufficiently rewarded, highly thought of as a novelist. And I know he has a line somewhere where he talks about the country's five leading novels, three are Jews, one's a black, and a single goy, he said. Yeah. I guess it must have been Updike was the single goy, John Updike. And he very much thought he deserved a much higher place, and I don't think he ever got over it.
Did you know him personally at all?
No, I did not know him. He once had Barr Epstein syndrome. He claimed I gave it to him.
Uh-huh.
He also was used. I once wrote a piece that has followed me around low for. It'll soon be five decades. In 1970, I wrote a piece about homosexuality and the complicated. This is just before gay liberation got going. And in it, I talked about how little is known about the origins of homosexuality. I talked about what is often thought to be the false tolerance of it, for it. People who pretend to be usually tolerant of homosexuality turn on homosexuals at the first chance they get. And I said at some point, it's caused so much grief in the world for the people who've had to live with it, that I wish not homosexuals, but homosexuality were removed from the face of the earth. And Gore Vidal took this to mean that I was advocating genocide, you know, and not a very sophisticated reading of what I had to say. And this, in all his books, he sort of takes a moment out to, you know, to blast me for this.
You are identified quite properly as essentially a conservative in your orientation to the wide world. Mm-hmm. And you've written directly in those terms with regard to public affairs, the degeneration or the coarsening of the culture, and yet other matters more directly on the dimension of liberal versus conservative. To what degree, as a conservative thinker, as a conservative responder, if not quite an active pamphleteer anymore, and you never were a pamphleteer, but you used to write more politically than you now do, to what degree have you used up your patience and your hope, and are you quieted somewhat as a conservative because things really look rather bleak beyond your own satisfying life?
Oh, that's a very rich and good question. I must say, I don't think of myself as a fully formed conservative in the sense that I don't have a theory of government. In a loose sense, I feel less government is generally better than more. And I'm made nervous by people who have 5-year plans or 20-year plans and the rest of it. Much of my conservatism comes out of a kind of anti-leftism, which I was first stung by when I saw what went on in the 60s. The 60s was a very big turning point in my general orientation to things. I think I was always a cultural conservative, but I think that the 60s made me very skeptical of what was going on in the left. I think it was a terrible generation and a very tough time. In fact, the great Rorschach test, as you know, Milt, is to ask anyone, what did you think of the 60s? And for some people, it was heaven itself, and for others, it was hellish. I suppose a lot had to do with one's age in the 60s. You know, I had two stepsons at that time who were teenagers, and I lived in considerable fear of, their dallying in drugs, and all. It was a very scary time if you had children. I suppose if you were single and free-ranging and a graduate student, it was probably a delightful time. But morally, I think the 60s has much to answer for.
Tell me something about, tell me more about charm. Do you agree with this from, of all people, Albert Camus, who says, you know what charm is, a way of getting the answer yes without having asked any clear question.
That's a wonderful quotation. Where did you get that? I have to ask.
From my very close reading of Albert Camus, of course. Though actually, brainy quote to be found on the internet may have something to do with it also.
Yes. Well, there's a lot to it. I mean, there is charm that is manipulative. You know, there's a kind of salesmanly-like charm. There's the charm of the seducer. There is charm that has a golden end, and then there's just charm that wants to be charming, that doesn't... the best charm, of course, is motiveless charm, that is to say, charm that someone just wants to give pleasure, give delight, arouse approval. That's the charm that interests me most of all.
But tell me, mentor, you must tell me as my mentor, what can I do now, rather late in life, to increase my quality of charm?
You're untoppable as you are.
Well, I'm really seeking a true definition of charm. And is it in some sense a teachable or a learnable skill?
I think nobody comes into the world charming. Uh-huh. So, I mean, some people have, the charm of good looks, obviously. and the good luck of growing up in surroundings where social relations are valued and honored. But I think it's something one does cultivate in oneself. One decides I want to be winning. You know, just as some people decide I'm a bully. The hell with it. You know, I don't care what anyone thinks of me, and I'm going to smash on through. You know, there's a little test I've run, which really sort of got me started on this charm book, is I've asked any number of people to name five living figures in public life today whom they think are charming. And, you know, no one has been able to do it. And I think one of the reasons is, this gets back to politics.
Yeah.
I think in the current atmosphere, you cannot be political and also charming. Because, you know, if you say, let us say, one says, well, I think President Obama's charming. Well, immediately half the country is going to say they're not. He's not. Or 47%, let's say, of the country is going to say, charming, are you kidding? He's a monster. He's a nightmare. The last charming politician I can think of, the only one I would care to go to lunch with in the Senate in the last 50 years was Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Could be charming.
A charming fellow. And, of course, yeah. an academic, basically, of Harvard professor of sociology.
Yeah, exactly.
I can think of one charming political figure from my childhood. Mm-hmm. And he did indeed charm me. He charmed me over the radio, in fact. Fiorello LaGuardia.
Oh, really? Yeah,
the mayor of New York. He charmed me over the radio because, you remember, there was a newspaper strike.
That's right.
Children were deprived of the comics. And he went on WNYC.
Oh, I remember hearing about this. Yeah.
And read on one particular Sunday, or on a series of Sundays. The strike lasted for about a month. And he read the comics to the children. And he was indeed a charming public presence other aspects of his comportment.
But you know, politics is anti-charming in a way, isn't it?
Because, sure.
People said FDR was greatly charming. I have memories of FDR, but I don't remember. They were too distant to me. I hadn't quite come into a grown-up consciousness enough to have a strong opinion about that. But, you know, you think of people like Babe Ruth was charming, I think. I can't think of an athlete now who is charming.
They're all too voracious in their lust for millions per season.
Yeah, there's that. I also think that something has happened. You know, two things I think have detracted from the charm of show business people. One is the triumph of psychotherapy, so that people go on talk shows and expose, you know, that they were abused as a child, or their father was an alcoholic, and somehow arousing sympathy isn't the same as charming. Whereas, you know, one thinks of Fred Astaire as charming.
And indeed, you've done a book about Fred Astaire.
I can't think of anyone today in show business who I say automatically is charming. Some people are nice. You know, Steve Martin is seems like a sweet character, and he stays apolitical. Well, here's a case. You know, George Clooney is somebody who is, I think, thought to be the successor to Cary Grant, to that sort of, big, young, that sort of charming actor. But because of his lining himself up with all sorts of political causes, he sheds his charm in a way, at least for half the population.
Well, since we're dealing with actors and actresses, to use a word that you're not supposed to use anymore for a woman.
That's right.
There are female actors and male actors, but I have a female actor who charmed me tremendously and continues to charm me whenever I catch an old movie of hers. Could you guess who that might be?
It's going to be Myrna Loy.
Well, it could very well be. I love Myrna Loy, in fact. But I'm thinking, she's second on my list.
Who is it? Barbara Stanwyck?
No, not at all, though I like her. I do like her. It's Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, yes. Well, by the way, I have a chapter on female charmers, and it's really about her.
Ah.
And the nice thing about this is she wasn't merely charming on screen, but she was a genuinely decent and charming person with a single weakness. She was seems to have been stimulated by worthlessness in men. She wasn't very good at choosing.
Well, she had a succession of three husbands, I think.
Well, there was first Mel Ferrer, who was kind of dope, from what everything I read. And then she married an Italian psychiatrist 10 years younger.
Yes, right. I remember that.
Then she, who cheated on her. And I think finally she didn't marry, but she lined up with a man who was Merle Oberon's former escort. We're talking about charm, but we're really talking about gossip now, aren't we?
Yeah, well,
they lied.
These things do overlap, of course.
But I think Audrey Hepburn is everybody's ideal of female elegance.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah,
well, here you are. You've worked with greed and envy, and now you're working with charm. And let's see.
I didn't do greed, but you know what I did? I did write a book on ambition. And which is you, in your mind, you may think of in that connection.
Yeah.
And I wrote that book out of a very different motive. I wrote the book Ambition. This appeared, I think, in 1978, maybe. I'm not sure of the date. But I wrote it in defense of ambition because I thought that ambition had been given a kind of bad name by the 60s generation, you know, the put down of capitalism, the put down of all ambition is greed, and I thought it needed a defense at that time, and soon thereafter, it needed no defense. You know, all the business schools got going, and all the kind of empty ambition that I think of sort of kicked in.
Still, you've touched many of the negative aspects of human nature, and now you're dealing with one of the positive ones, except that charm, of course, can be developed as a kind of a trick to misuse people. But more broadly, I asked you the other day when we were talking about doing this conversation, what do you think unites all of these separate books of yours dealing with human nature? And you said probably the best phrase would be the human comedy, which is a direct steal from Balzac, who titles all of his 90 novels or so with one great overarching concept. He calls them as a total enterprise, la comédie humaine, the human comedy.
Yes, exactly.
So what does one learn from the human comedy?
In a way, there really is only one great subject, I think, and it's human nature.
Yeah.
I don't know if you agree or not. As a psychologist, you probably do. I hope you do. And it's a subject about which we are no more intelligent, you know, in 2013 than we were in 1642. It's subject of endless speculation with no firm conclusions that I can make out.
Well, is there a human nature? That's the question. Or is
I was going to say, is there? It starts with at the beginning with that.
You know, I am. You mentioned my being a psychologist. As you know, I'm a social psychologist.
Right.
One of the main themes in modern social psychology is picked up and sort of revives an idea which you find well expressed way back in classical antiquity by Theophrastus, who writes a book called The Characters, and is picked up 2,500 years later, I suppose, by William James, of all people, in his psychology. The notion that can be called peripheralism, that you become what you do, that there is no really central identity which lasts across a life. You can best manipulate people if you get them to do things that aren't typical of their real repertoire, and you give them minimum reward for it. They then need to find a justification for doing something so counter-attitudinal, and that justification is to then decide what is a counter-attitudinal now becomes my true attitude. In other words, I am what you desire me to be, or I am what you reward me to be. We certainly know that certain kinds of profession are transformative. of the people who enter into those professions succeed in them more than they ever really expected they would and become a different person. For a young, sort of shy kid who all the same goes to law school, becomes a lawyer, and becomes very good, whether at estates and wills or in courtroom performance, something is going to change, basically. His nature will be formed in some real part by what he does rather than who he is.
That sounds very smart. I recently wrote an essay for Commentary Magazine. I think it's going to appear in the September issue on the subject of genius, which is, of course, a very rich subject. And, you know, there are certain eras in which one could become a genius. That, you know, if in Athens, in Greece, which we're really talking mostly about Athens, a genius was possible in thought and art. In Rome, it was about administration and military. In the Middle Ages, a genius was religion. Geniuses were saints. In the Enlightenment, it turns to art again. So even as a genius, in the 18th century, in music, there's a great number of musical geniuses. But again, if you ask about genius, and then scientific geniuses, of course. But I'm not sure what the outlet for genius is in our time. Is Steve Jobs a genius? I don't think so. Or Bill Gates. Geniuses may be as rare as today as charming people.
In intellectual life, the people I find most impressive are indeed a certain kind of scientist. What I have in mind are the cosmological physicists and people like this fellow Guth, who takes us to the edge of a fantastic new conception that and has a basis for it, that there may well be a multiple number of universes, possibly even an infinity of universes. That's the kind of an idea that you can barely get your mind around, but it's very exciting, particularly if he's got a basis in his own scientific research for formulating that vision. Surely Einstein, by our modern measure, was a genius.
Yes, well, you know, the definition I came up with for my is to kind of keep the standard of genius high.
Yeah.
Because nowadays, you know, one might say Bill Belichick, the coach of the New England Patriots, is a genius. Well, he's not. He's just a good coach. The standard I came up with is a genius is someone who has made us view the world differently than we would have done without his having been on the scene. And that limits, you know, this. The man with the multiple universes looks like he's in the position of doing so if he can make his theory believable. Mm-hmm. I must say, one of the things it does automatically, if he's right, is it even increases even further, if that's possible, the insignificance of all our lives, isn't it?
Utterly and totally. What do you make of a fellow who says the following? I just know so many people who have six or seven foreign languages and have read everything and have musical training, and they are still dorks.
I think I know that person.
It's you, yes.
Yeah, isn't that one of the... actually, dorks was a euphemism. I think I should have said schmucks, no?
All right.
yes, no, it's...
Well, That touches upon another area in which you've written a good deal, namely Jewish identity. And you've got a wonderful recent review of an author who did a book, and this is Ruth Weiss, who did a book on Jewish humor, which is on the series of podcasts which you are now joining right now.
Good. Ruth Weiss is very smart. And,
very smart.
From my standpoint, I think probably yours, sort of on the right side of things. And
So why did you hold back from schmuck and use dorks instead?
I'm trying to remember where I wrote that. It must have been, the place that I wrote it that I said dorks. But you know, it is a great question that people who have attained to vast culture don't seem to be nice people necessarily. You'd have thought that. You know, being in the presence of great music, of rich literature, would have altered their character, changed their nature for the better. But Not necessarily. I mean, is that not your experience too, or am I?
Well, it's a common mode of disappointment. You know, I did for many years that talk show for five nights a week.
Yes,
and
exactly.
all sorts of eminentos came.
Right.
Some were invited because I so much admired their work, their public performance, their writing, and they would turn out to be, some of them, not all of them, true dorks. Mm-hmm. And rather lacking in the ordinary skills of courtesy and the ordinary traits of normal sociability. Whereas others would show up on that program so as to give proper argument to some other guest whom I thought more of, but the man who was giving the argument against views by the other guest who held my sort of views turned out to be far more charming than his opponent. These days, that would mean, and it did mean, I might have a debate between a conservative and a leftist, and the leftist, unaccountably, and really in a way that disturbed me a bit, was a much nicer guy than was the conservative.
You must have been in this condition, too, of being in a room with people whose political views are roughly congruent with your own, and you look around and you say, God, this is an unattractive gathering. I must go home and reconsider my opinion.
Yes.
I think Orwell was right. You shouldn't go out.
Do you remember Jeanette MacDonald singing, Ah, Sweet Mystery of Life?
Oh, yes.
Probably by Sigmund Romberg or one of those guys?
Yes, it sounds right. At last I found you.
Exactly. Well, have you found it? That's what we come to. What is the sweet mystery or the only mystery of life? Have you solved it?
Yeah. You know, this reminds me of a great influence in my life. I think the only living intellectual influence was my friend Edward Schills, whom I met in the 70s. And Edward Schills once said, I wonder if this remark will impress you as it did me. He was talking about his colleagues in the economics department at the University of Chicago. And there would be Milton Friedman, George Stiglitz, Gary Becker. These are all men who won Nobel Prizes, as you know, in economics. And I suppose it's a dubious question whether there should be a Nobel Prize
By the way, dare I correct you? It isn't Stiglitz, it's Stigler.
Stigler, you're rough. Thank you for that. There was a Joseph Stiglitz, also an economist, but I shouldn't. I knew that George Stigler, and I shouldn't get it wrong. But in any case, Edward Schill said to me, I remember this so clearly, he said, you know, Joseph, these men are obviously men of high intelligence, high IQ. They're very smart. And I like them. He said, they're nice men. He said, but, you know, they're insufficiently impressed by the mysteries of life.
Uh-huh.
And that seemed to me so true of a certain kind of, certainly economic intellectual. They, you know, they're sure they know have the answers. And as I grow older, I find that the number of mysteries increases, and I'm not much closer to unraveling them.
Well, what's your version of the ultimate mystery? I will give you mine in a moment. Let me hear yours.
What am I doing here?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it'd be, you know, why me, which is gives it a nice paranoid touch. But it all seems so mysterious. I mean, you know, we solved a little problems. How do I make a living? How do I get to do this or that? But the great mysteries just keep looming.
That preoccupies me, a few people have finally turned to addressing it in speculative literature, is as formulated, I think, by Nietzsche, though the question's been around for much longer. But I think in Nietzsche's words, it's quite simply, why is there anything rather than nothing?
Yes, yeah, I think that is.
That's something.
And, you know, Wittgenstein picks up the ball on that one, I believe, too. And, you know,
and can't answer it either.
That's right.
In that regard, his famous dictum at the end of his Tractatus, of that of which you cannot speak, you must remain silent.
Exactly.
And probably applies.
And that of which we can't speak is the thing we talk most about, though, most of us, I think. So. But no, but it's still, it's, the world is full of amusing things, and I count myself very lucky in life in having been allowed for most of my life to, you know, to just read good and interesting books and write about them and write about things that interest me.
Well, your writing is a great joy, whatever mode you're in.
Well, that's very pleasing.
You've even done fiction, which I've not said a word about, wonderful short stories. A number of them were collected in the volume The Golden Boys, is that right?
Well, I have three collections. One is The Golden Boys. I have a book of stories. The one that's had the sort of the greatest play is a book called Fabulous Small Jews.
Yes, indeed, right.
That comes from a Carl Shapiro poem called Hospital, which, as I recall, it runs, this hospital, it says, this Oxford of sicknesses, kings have lain here, and fabulous small Jews, yeah, and actresses whose legs were always news.
Yes.
But fabulous small Jews, I always see, Milt, someone coming out of the 3400 building on Lakeshore Drive in a camel hair coat, a manicure and a wonderful shoe shine, you know. Fabulous small Jews. Anyhow, and then I have a book of stories called The Love Song of A. Jerome Minkoff, and I'm hoping to publish another book of stories. Yeah.
Well, those three books are filled with wonderful stories, and they are all more or less set in or around Chicago, and
yes,
they're all about local Jews, so to speak.
Yeah.
Some drawn from life, obviously, though appropriately reshaped. Are you ever going to venture out of Chicago in your short stories, as you have done surely in all of your other writing?
Well, I've done a little bit about in New York. You know, I've lived only in three places in my life. I lived in the South for a few years, and I lived in New York for 3 years when I was a young man. Being an Easterner, probably weren't told as I was by my father, you know, if you really want to make it, you have to go to New York. And I think in those days, if you wanted to have self-confidence, you had to have the feeling that you've not conquered New York, but at least lived through it. I don't think people think about it that way anymore. But
well, we have been discussing the human comedy and the interesting take on the human comedy that we get from one of the most talented writers in these United States, namely Joseph Epstein. The forthcoming book will be titled what? Not just Charm, but there will be a subtitle.
I don't have a locked-in title, but I was thinking of calling it Who Killed Charm.
Who Killed Charm. Excellent.
Yes, this is one possibility.
So we've done the La Commedia Humaine, now ending in Italian and from Pagliacci. La Commedia è finita.
Of course. Yes, of course.
The comedy is finished because time has run out. Joe, thank you so much for joining me.
A pleasure, Milt, as always. Hope to see you soon.
I'm sure that will be the case. Bye-bye for now.
Take care.